And now, a look back at some of the big stories of 2024. Earning a college degree comes with extra challenges for single mothers. Baltimore's newest branch of the Jeremiah program is trying to ease that burden. The Charm City chapter helped five moms graduate from local universities in the past year. WIPR's Bree Hatch gave us a closer look that followed three Jeremiah program women, at a storytelling event in October.
In a Goucher College atrium on a Wednesday night, Executive Director Danielle Staten introduces three moms about to take the stage.
The stories of single mothers are often hidden or told through the lens of just struggle and sacrifice. But tonight, we are here to reclaim those narratives.
One of the moms just finished a bachelor's degree in business administration. The other transferred to the University of Maryland College Park this fall to study public health. The third mom, Ebony Peacock, said she's in the process of rebuilding her life. She's in her first semester of classes at Baltimore City Community College, having just joined the Jeremiah program this summer. On stage, Peacock tells the story of her move back to West Baltimore after fleeing an abusive marriage in Mississippi with her two kids.
I am fearful for my life, and I have to get out. So that's what I did. I have epilepsy. I'm not supposed to be driving, but I drove the longest I've ever driven.
Bree Hatch is WIPR's education reporter. They join me now here in Studio A. I mean, it's a great story, Bree. I mean, these women, you know, getting this really crucial support. There was some other big education news just yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. The city school system is rolling out a new violence intervention pilot at four high schools. They're partnering like on the ground community-based organizations to run mediation sessions and build some conflict resolution skills with students there. So more coming. We're going to see how that program plays out. But four high schools have been doing it since the beginning of the school year.
Yeah, we had Stephanie Moronis here on midday yesterday, and that was before the press release or the press conference when they announced it. So she was pretty tight-lipped about it. So this is going to be schools partnering with various things. It's kind of like the violence interventions that Safe Streets does and to a lesser extent ROCA, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're going to have some student ambassadors who are starting in January to sort of lead the effort on a peer level. So it's a whole sort of school community and larger community effort is the idea.
All right. Bree Hatch is WIPR's education reporter. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And yesterday, Governor Wes Moore announced that more than $50 million in grants to 43 neighborhood organizations and agencies have been committed to in the FY 2025 budget. That will be top of mind for everybody in Annapolis when the legislature reconvenes in just a few weeks. And during a community walk in Westport in October, WIPR's Wamboi Kamau found that leaders were organizing to secure their neighborhood a place in the state's efforts.
Located on the banks of the Patapsco River, Westport sits south of the Inner Harbor. After a brief prayer and safety instructions, staff and volunteers from various organizations start walking and engaging with residents.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
Once a bustling industrial hub, Westport had shipyards, factories, and warehouses. As those industries shut down, the population declined. Longtime resident Stanley Brown has seen the neighborhood change over the years.
And at one time, I could come outside with no shoes on and never even cut my feet.
Wow.
In the alleys and the main streets. That's how nice it is. Yes. I'd love to see it go back.
Yeah.
I really would.
He's speaking with Lisa Hodges-Hyken, who is the executive director of Westport CEDC, a nonprofit working to boost economic development in the area. Hodges-Hyken says absentee landlords are a big reason why there are so many vacant properties. She says they buy and hold, causing the neighborhood to deteriorate.
They are just making it difficult for folks to live because with the vacants comes squatters, which also then comes trash and debris, which then comes rats, which also comes human trafficking.
And WIPR's Wamboi Kamau covers Baltimore and beyond for our news department, and she's here with me in the studio. It's good to see you.
Hello, hello.
So there are a couple of initiatives that have happened in the last couple of gubernatorial administrations. Governor Larry Hogan had something he called Project CORE, and now Governor Wes Moore has something called Project or Reinvest Baltimore. What's the difference between those two programs?
So the difference here is that besides the name,
it's still the same amount of money, which is about $50 million coming into the city annually to accelerate their efforts to tackle vacant housing, which they consider a crisis. With under Governor Moore, there's a little bit more coordination. He formed what's called the BVRI, which stands for the Baltimore Vacants Reinvestment Initiative. And this has a panel of people such as Jake Day, who is the state's Secretary of Housing, and Alice Kennedy, who is the city's Secretary of Housing, and a couple other people in the nonprofit and private sector talking about, hey, this is a big problem. Like, there's a little under 13,000 vacant properties in the city right now. That does not include vacant lots. And it's all about how can we tackle this? How can we do this all around the city versus before, where they were just looking at this neighborhood or this part of the city?
Yeah, and in the Project Core funding, as I recall it, Governor Hogan was more intent kind of on just tearing stuff down, making sure that, you know, the vacants were cleared and you'd end up with open space. This seems to be a little bit more coordinated approach about developing some of those places, right?
Absolutely, Tom. So with Reinvest Baltimore or the BVRI, demolition can still happen. However, it seems like there's more of a primary focus on stabilizing neighborhoods, stabilizing blocks, and that's another difference, is blocks versus just individual properties.
And you also covered Zeke Cohen, among others, on the campaign trail this year. Of course, we had big primary elections and then a big general election for local offices this past month. And he, of course, was successful in his bid to become the president of the Baltimore City Council. Previously, he had represented the first councilmanic district. And during the primary, you followed him when he was still a councilman. And in your reporting, you captured the new council president talking with a voter about his concerns for city residents.
I want to make sure all of our schools have heat and air conditioning. I want to make sure we got universal pre-K in this city like DC does.
Yeah.
I want to make sure our streets are a little more safe. Law enforcement needs to be community policing. Walking, talking to folks.
Yeah.
And then just the quality of life. Trash and recycle should be picked up weekly. The pools need to open up on time.
Yes.
Rec centers, all of that.
Especially when it's hot.
Exactly.
And, of course, you know, Zeke Cohen said all through his campaign during the primary and the general election that the days of the city council ignoring the school system were over. You know, we're going to have much more acute oversight. In these early weeks of his councilmanic presidency, and he was only sworn in, you know, a couple of weeks ago, any signs that he's making good on that promise?
Well, my colleague Emily Hofstetter covered the BOE, the Board of Estimates, which is the city spending board, and the council president sits on that. And she reported that he is really commanding that oversight process by asking a lot of questions. And one of the things that's on there today is about the city's water rates potentially going up.
Yeah, and there's a big increase proposed by the DPW, some 15%, which could come into effect as early as February. They don't mess around when they decide to increase. They don't wait for 8 months. They just, you know, they're throwing it in basically in 6 weeks. Okay, Wamboy Kamau, always good to see you. Thank you for your reporting, and we'll see you in the new year.
Thank you, Tom.
And speaking of Emily Hofstetter, on the 2nd of August, Baltimore sanitation worker Ronald Silver II succumbed to hyperthermia or heat sickness while working on his trash collection route. His death was one of approximately 43 workers across the country who die annually of heat exhaustion. Emily examined one of Maryland communities, a community here in Maryland that's working to stay ahead in worker safety.
Jamie Sitikov is Rockville's safety and risk manager. Back in the late 2010s, she remembers the heat was becoming a big problem.
So there'd be often times where, you know, someone gets a call over dispatch that someone's in heat stress, and then we're responding either by calling 911 or responding with our crew supervisors.
One year, the team reported 5 heat incidents for a team with fewer than 30 sanitation workers. Rockville's safety and risk team put together a comprehensive heat safety plan before things took a deadly turn. It has a series of different precautions that must be taken at different heat index triggers.
We have acclimatization procedures that go into effect where if someone hasn't been here or if somebody's new less than 2 weeks, we will watch them specifically, they also aren't required to work the full day. They'll work a portion of the day.
On really hot days, she says supervisors will intercept workers on their routes for a check-in, passing out extra water and electrolytes to crews that need it. Training is crucial, Sitikov says, and teaching crews how to recognize heat sickness in the first place.
They're a two-man team. You know, they're on a truck. There's two of them. They're out there. They are really the first line of defense.
And Mr. Silver's death, Ronald Silver's death, led to a review of worker safety standards here in Baltimore conducted by a law firm in Washington, and the city committing to upgrading protocols in response to that report, as well as several scathing critiques by the Baltimore Office of the Inspector General. We are grateful to Emily for her reporting, talking about how Rockville is handling that issue. And 60 years ago, back in 1964, America was in the grip of Beatlemania. On September 13th of that year, the Beatles came to town for their only appearance here in Baltimore. Screaming kids packed Baltimore's Civic Center, and John Lee gave us this look back.
First, let's set the Beatlemania scene 60 years ago.
It's been a
The Beatles' first movie, A Hard Day's Night, was released in the U.S. in August. They were on their first U.S. tour. 7 months had passed since their legendary appearance on The Ed Sullivan Show in February. Scott Freiman hosts the series, Deconstructing the Beatles, on public television.
A Hard Day's Night, the movie had come out and been a massive, massive hit. And their singles, you know, kept coming out and kept hitting the top of the charts. So they were on an all-time high.
Then they land in Baltimore. An estimated crowd of around 5,000 teens was outside the Civic Center, known these days as the CFG Bank Arena. The late Gilbert Sandler, a renowned teller of Baltimore tales on WYPR, told the story of 16-year-old Eleanor Livingston, who dressed like a hotel maid and tried to convince Police Inspector Leo Kelly to let her in.
She says that she is the Beatles' personal maid and must get into their dressing room at once. She says she is late. The Beatles are waiting inside for her to help them get ready. Kelly gives her a you-don't-say look, but is not amused and tells her to get back in line.
Then the show began. This recording is from the Hollywood Bowl, not Baltimore, but you get the idea.
And the pandemonium, the screams, and the flash cameras going off. They were like strobe lights.
WYPR producer Bob White was there. He got the tickets for his 11th birthday the day before. His mom took him.
I've got girls in back of me pulling on my hair and wiggling me, going, there they are, there they are. You know, and my mother turns around and goes, don't do that to him. Oh, thanks, Mom. I needed that.
$28,000 tickets were sold for two shows. White was at the evening show. His cousin, Karen Garthy, caught the one in the afternoon.
It was mad female hormones. And all my girlfriends, everybody was an insane Beatlemaniac.
The Beatles played for about 30 minutes. Fans like Kathy White Nichols had to wait through several warm-up acts. She called the wait to see them, especially her favorite Beatle, Paul McCartney, excruciating.
Because it was so chaotic and everyone was screaming, I didn't really get to hear him.
The day after the concert, Nichols had another close Beatle encounter while in class at Mercy High School.
I could see there was some stirrings going on in the hallway.
George Harrison wanted to see a modern American high school and was getting a tour. School president Mary Beth Lennon, no relation, says the founding principal, Sister Michelle Carroll, showed him around.
Sister Michelle, in her full habit as a Sister of Mercy, glided through the halls with Mr. Harrison past classrooms.
There's a plaque about the visit over a 1960s water fountain where it's believed George stopped for a drink. The fountain no longer works. It's now a Baltimore monument to Beatlemania. John Lee, WYPR News.
And it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Up next, we continue our look at some of the stories that have stayed with us from 2024. We thank John Lee and all of the reporters from WYPR for taking us through this little trip down memory lane. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It is Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, WYPR's very own survivor, Gabe Ortiz, joins me to talk about his experience as a contestant on Survivor 47, which will end tonight. He didn't win, but he had a great run. We'll also talk about Ravens football in advance of their huge game with the Pittsburgh Steelers on Saturday. And Jaywin Russick will review the art-centric production of Black Nativity. So that's all on the way tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, we're checking in with my colleagues in the WYPR newsroom to check out the top stories of 2024. On March 26th of this year, the historic landscape in Baltimore was, of course, forever altered. As we discussed with the governor earlier in the program today, a cargo ship that had lost power struck the Key Bridge, collapsing the 50-year-old structure in a matter of seconds. Six construction workers who were patching potholes on the bridge were killed. And in this report, which aired in April, WYPR's Scott Massioni looked at ships that fly flags of convenience. That means it's registered in a country to take advantage of lax regulations and standards.
The National Transportation Safety Board is investigating the cause of the collision. However, many believe maintenance or human error issues led to the wreck. Now, professional mariners are wondering if the complicated world of shipping regulations may be a threat to other U.S. ports. There are 32 flags of convenience, according to the International Transport Workers Federation. Those flags offer lower fees, taxes, and loose safety and labor laws.
It invites a lot of people taking advantage of the deregulation that a lot of the flag states offer.
David Heindel is the president of the Seafarers International Union.
And they basically let the ship owners regulate themselves.
And Scott Massioni joins me here in the studio. So, Scott, you know, there's a bunch of issues here. Rebuilding the bridge, we talked to the governor about that. Who's going to pay for that? We talked to the governor and others about that. But there's also the issue of continued safety, you know, and an upgrade of safety protocols. Has anything happened in that regard since last March?
Well, we've definitely seen some interest from Congress. We've seen some interest from other academic sort of sources like Johns Hopkins University that are looking into how our infrastructure can handle these large ships. What's happened over the years is that these ships have gotten larger and had more demand to carry more things in order to increase their profit or make their profit. While on the other hand, our infrastructure has stayed the same, much like the Key Bridge from the 70s, where it wasn't prepared to take on a ship that was three times the size of the Statue of Liberty. So, you know, when we're looking at these sorts of things, you know, there is a large disparity between how our economy works today and the infrastructure that the United States has. So, you know, Johns Hopkins, their academic research right now is looking into how these bridges will be able to handle large ships and which ones are the most vulnerable to strikes or to possible dangers.
Yeah, and in case you missed the top of our show, listeners, I did speak with Governor Moore about the fact that the continuing resolution that's been proposed in Congress yesterday includes full funding for a rebuild of the Key Bridge. But when it comes to safety of, for example, the Bay Bridge, Scott, I mean, what are people thinking about, you know, that another historic, iconic structure?
Right. I mean, there's many things that are possible. There's things called dolphins that they can install, which are sort of like gravel that go back from the areas where the concrete is put in and that holds structurally the bridge. But even more than that, you know, there is a larger systemic issue here, which is, like we talked about, the flags of convenience, where there are ships out there fly under countries that have lax regulations and therefore have more susceptibility to the issues that the Dali had, which are electric issues, crews that are short-staffed or don't have enough sleep, all sorts of issues. And then once again, as we were saying, the infrastructure that is not prepared to work with how we run our economy today.
Scott Malcioni covers health issues for WIPR and clearly a whole bunch more. So thank you very much, Scott. Appreciate it and have a great holiday.
Thank you. You too.
And each year, hundreds of Maryland teens find themselves face to face with a judge and two possible outcomes, a judgment in adult court and possible prison time, or a transfer to the juvenile court and the opportunity to get therapy and other services. And it's up to the judge to decide. An investigation by WIPR and APM Reports released in March found that some judges are using what juvenile justice advocates say are arbitrary and inconsistent reasons to keep teenagers charged with serious crimes in adult court. Here's part of Rachel Bay's report.
Each year, Maryland automatically charges hundreds of juveniles in adult court, more than almost any other state. Nearly all of the teens charged are Black boys. Research shows teens are more likely to reoffend when they are charged as adults. We reviewed more than three dozen hearings to see how judges made decisions to keep cases in adult court. We found judges and prosecutors sometimes relied on dubious reasoning to argue teens should be tried as adults. For example, this is Baltimore City Judge Emmanuel Brown.
He is listed physically as being 6'1" tall and 164.4 pounds. That factor weighs against transfer.
Chronic absences from school, sexual activity, and tattoos were among the reasons offered. We also came across decisions that seemed to contradict each other. Getting decent grades or skipping school would be used in different cases to say the same thing. A kid should be tried as an adult.
And Rachel Bay is our senior reporter and editor here, and she joins me here in the studio. And Rachel, this issue has been, in front of the legislature for a long time. Do you expect it'll be in front of them again in January when they reconvene? And if so, with any, increased scrutiny?
Yeah, so it has been introduced in the legislature for more than a decade to efforts to try to stop charging kids automatically as adults and start all juvenile cases in juvenile court. But I have been told by the head of the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee that he plans to introduce a bill that would curtail this practice significantly. It would not completely get rid of automatic charging of some teens as adults, but it would drastically reduce the amount of kids who end up charged automatically as adults. And so I think we could see some movement on this issue for the first time in really more than a decade.
I spoke with Davon Love, who's a political director for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, a progressive organization that does a lot of lobbying. And I know that they want this to be top of mind for them. This is a top priority for them. So we're looking back, but I also want to look a little ahead to the next legislative session. And yesterday you attended a press conference with Senate President Bill Ferguson. The budget is going to weigh heavily on lawmakers when they come back in January. What did he have to say about, perhaps the prospect for new taxes?
Yeah, I mean, he basically said that cuts aren't going to cut it, not to pun not intended, but you're not going to be able to close. They're dealing with a $2.5 billion deficit just in the coming fiscal year. You're not going to be able to close that just with cuts, is what he's saying. And some new revenues are going to have to be on the table. And of course, when lawmakers say the word revenue, that means taxes. So we could be looking at taxes on digital products and services that haven't been taxed before. He said he also they could be looking at rolling back some tax credits, tax programs that are not serving the economy the way lawmakers had hoped they would. So a lot of things could be on the table, but at the same time, Republican leaders have made it very, very clear they do not want to see any tax increases. And they, on the other hand, are talking about all the different ways that we could see some cuts.
These are significant comments because this is a very different tone than he took last year. He and the governor both basically said, nope, forget taxes. We're not talking about it. We're not talking about revenue enhancements in last year's session. So this does seem like there's an opening here, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This is a very different tone. I will say politics are always a factor as to the timing of when lawmakers start to talk about tax increases. You're not going to see lawmakers talking about tax increases in an election year. And so this is kind of the last year. Next year is 2026 is the next time you have statewide elections. So it's unlikely to see tax increases in the 2026 legislative session. So 2025 is kind of their chance to do it if they think that the state needs it. And it is definitely noteworthy that you hear the Senate president making these comments.
Rachel Bay is a senior reporter and editor here at WIPR. Thank you so much. We will talk to you in the new year. You'll be down there in Annapolis for every day of the session, and I can guarantee we'll be in touch.
Absolutely.
Happy New Year. Thanks Happy so new much. Year. And up next, the top 10 tunes of 2024. Megan Bird and Tyler LaPorte of WTMD will help us count down the best music of the year. On the other side of a quick break, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.